chapter 2. If you have a Bible from the back, it's page 411. Page 411. The year was 1985. A funeral service is being taken place in Knoxville, Tennessee. Here's the interesting thing about this funeral service. They were honoring a man who had died in February of 1953. This funeral service is 85, and the man had died in February of 51. The gentleman's name is Bill Wallace. Let me show you a picture of him. You can see him there, smack dab in the middle. Wallace was a Baptist medical missionary from Tennessee, and he was serving with the International Mission Board. After receiving his medical degree from the University of Tennessee, and after doing his residency, he picked up as a single missionary and arrived in China in 1935. He served faithfully with distinction for the next 16 years, and while tumultuous, those next 16 years were fruitful years for Wallace. He used medicine as his primary means, as avenue to share the gospel. Wallace would survive the political uprisings that happened in every country. He survived the Japanese invasion of China, World War II. But he would not survive the communists in 1949. In fact, it was in December of 1950 when communist soldiers entered his village in the hospital where Wallace and other medical missionaries were serving. He was imprisoned on false charges of espionage. And for the next 3 months, three long months, Wallace endured incredible torture, both physical and psychological. Daily, even sometimes hourly, often through the night, he was brought before his tormentors. He was overwhelmed by the interrogations, and he would often return back to his prison cell delirious and crying. And for 3 months, he endured torture at the hands of brutal soldiers. In fact, it was a lonely battle in which Wallace, through documents that they would find, was lonely, which only Bill Wallace and the Lord himself, who loved Bill, could face. He was by himself, and then one night something went terribly wrong. In an effort to break him, in an effort to force a false confession, they went too far. And in February of 1951, Bill Wallace was killed. I'm going to bring Bill Wallace's name up later on in the message. But I bring his story to your attention for this reason. Those final 3 months specifically, his life generally, but those final 3 months specifically, the theme of Bill Wallace's life, those final 3 months, is the theme of our chapter, Esther 2 and Esther 3 this morning. And the theme is this, from Esther 2 and Esther 3 and Wallace's life, that God's silence is not a demonstration of unfaithfulness, but rather preparation to display His greater plan. Let me say it again to you, that God's silence is not a demonstration of unfaithfulness, but rather preparation to display His greater plan. And we will pull that theme from Esther 2 and 3 as we walk through it this morning. So our message this morning is titled, The Drama of Divine Providence. The Drama of Divine Providence. From our section or our text that was read to us this morning, it appears that Queen Esther has used her influence in the kingdom to place Mordecai sitting at the gate. I don't know if you recall that phrase in Esther chapter 2, verse 19 or not. But that phrase, to sit at the gate, it does not mean that the city is here and Mordecai just happens to find an extra park bench outside and he's sitting down somewhere. No. This is an expression that Mordecai holds a position of authority within the Persian court. That's why I say that Esther flexed her queenly muscle to allow her uncle to be in a position of authority. And while in this sitting in this position of authority, Mordecai overhears a plot. He overhears a plot between the two eunuchs. The eunuchs were the right-hand men, the trusted soldiers who would be right next to Ahasuerus. The men who had access to the king. And Mordecai wisely gives this information to Esther. And Esther, in turn, relays the details to King Ahasuerus, and she does so in her uncle's name, Mordecai. Well, let's read this, Esther chapter 2, verse 19. Now, when the virgins were gathered together the second time, this is about 6 years after Esther has been chosen as king, and you can figure out the timeline when you read the chapter. This is the second time Ahasuerus is a sensual man. Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai. And he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. Not be the first time we see gallows in this book. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Now, what you would expect to see in verse 1 of chapter 3 is that immediately who is promoted? Mordecai, right? But look at Esther chapter 3, verse 1. After these things, what things? Well, what just happened? After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. What? Haman the Agagite? Who's Haman? Where did he come from? And what happened to Mordecai? That's, as someone reading a narrative, if you're reading a novel, you would be thinking to yourself, this is a non sequitur. There's no logical sense by the author here. Where did Haman come from? I imagine that Mordecai is thinking something to this effect. God, are you watching? Do you see what's going on? I see in our passage this morning three realities for God's children who are unsure of God's presence in the midst of trials. Three realities for us when we are unsure of God's presence while we're in the midst of trials. Like, God, do you see me? Here's reality number one. Do not interpret God's silence as ignorance or indifference. Christian, do not interpret God's silence as ignorance or indifference. Do not consider God to be unaware or uncaring. Your Father in heaven is not blind or deaf, detached or disinterested. In fact, later on, the passage actually explains why God is silence. And then drama is introduced into the story by a two-word description of Haman. He's called the Agagite. What in the world is an Agagite? Now let me explain this. To be an Agagite is to be an Amalekite. Doesn't that help you? I'm kidding, right? No. Yeah. To be an Agagite is to be an Amalekite. Now, let me explain what that means. Especially if you're like, I have no idea what you're saying. You're getting into Old Testament stuff I have no clue about, Pastor Joel, right? You're lucky I can find the book of Esther, all right? I have no idea what does an Agagite and an Amalekite have to do with each other. Here's what you got. The Amalekites hold the distinction for being the very first country or nation, let's call them that, the very first people group, nation, that attacks the nation of Israel when they leave Egypt. Right? So when you're reading the book of Exodus and they finally get away from Pharaoh and you come on early on in the book of Exodus, all of a sudden there's this people that attacks Israel for the first time. Those are the Amalekites. Okay? So you got the Amalekites. Now, fast forward in your brain all the way to the book of 1 Samuel. And we read about a king for Israel. His name is Saul. King Saul. He is a son of Kish, a Benjaminite. All right? I'll tie it up here in a second. He's the son of Kish. He's a Benjaminite. And here's what happens in 1 Samuel 15. King Saul is told to completely destroy the Amalekites. Wipe them out. They are the sworn enemy of my people, Israel. And the king of the Amalekites, his name is Agag. And so the Amalekites and the Agagites are similar. They're the same. It'd be like saying, do you live in the United States or do you live in America? Right? Same difference. The Agagites and the Amalekites are the same people. They was used interchangeably. And then in Esther chapter 2, verse 5, Mordecai is referred to, he's described this way. He too is a son of Kish, a Benjaminite, right? And so if you were reading through your Old Testament and you kind of had logged in your mind, oh yeah, King Saul, he's the son of Kish, he's a Benjaminite, whatever, I don't know if I'll ever use that information ever again. And all of a sudden you come up on Esther, and you're like, wait a second, son of Kish, a Benjaminite? I've heard that phrase before. And all of a sudden you recognize that what's going on here is this. Drama is being introduced into the story of Esther with two sworn enemies of each other that are personified. These two nations now are personified in Mordecai and in Haman. Only here's the difference. This time, who's sitting on the throne? There's no King Saul to rescue the Jewish people from the Amalekites or Agagites. Take your pick how you call them. Right? There's no king to fight for her, Israel. And so the story of Esther is escalating. The drama is increasing. Because Mordecai, the Jew, just gave some very valuable piece of information. And instead of the Jew being raised and placed into a position of prominence, who was placed into a position of prominence? The sworn enemy of Israel, the Agagite, the Amalekites. So drama and tension increase. Why? When we feel or know that God is silent in our story. In fact, we could even put it this way. That God's silence is at best frustrating, and at worst, it is faith crippling to His people. But do not think that God's silence, or do not interpret God's silence as ignorance or indifference. Second reality I see in the text is this. Do not forget, Christian, that God's people are targets for destruction. Do not forget that God's people are targets for destruction. Let me show this to you. I'm in Esther chapter 3 now, and I'm looking at verse 5. And in verse 5, we read it this way. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Now I wonder why. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast poor. That is, they cast lots. They threw some dice before Haman day after day. And they cast it month after month until the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom, right? The laws are different from those of every other people. And they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them, Ahasuerus. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it in the king's treasury. Basically, I will fund the campaign against these people. He doesn't identify who they are, but I will fund it personally. And he's probably going to fund it because he's probably going to loot their homes, right? And take that and then give the rest into the coffers of Ahasuerus. Verse 10, so the king took his signet ring from his hand, think large college ring here, and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you. Friends, this is not historical fiction. These are real people, with real lives, real children, and real fears. And Haman begins by casting pure. Well, let me show you a picture of what this would look like. See that? It's a six-sided, it's dice. And every day from the very first month until the 12th month, so how often, how long did they pull out the dice? Every day. And they would roll them. This is not a game, like a board game, like you and I would think. For a Persian, this is not a game of chance, but rather divination. The Persians are seeking counsel from their gods. When would be the most appropriate and best time, O God, small g, to pursue the annihilation and extermination of my enemy, the Jewish people? And here's what you have. Yahweh, the God of Israel, has the pure fall so as to create a question. Here's the thing, right? We talked about sovereignty in our Sunday school lesson this morning. Yahweh has the pure fall so as to create a question in his people's hearts. Haman is trying to figure out from his small g gods when would be the best time to exterminate the Jewish people. Yahweh so configures and allows the dice to fall in such a way that he is going to do something in his people's hearts. And I'll show you what that is in a moment. But Christian, throughout biblical history, God's people have always been targets for destruction from the beginning. It was the intent of the serpent, right? To destroy the relationship between God and his two children, Adam and Eve, our first parents. Trace the bullseye of destruction all throughout the scriptures, spiritually and physically. And you will arrive at this disturbing realization that the devil will do anything to destroy God's people, to disrupt God's work, and to dismantle God's plan. In fact, let me show this to you from the very beginning. So keep your hands in Esther. Turn to your very first book of the Bible and the third chapter, chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3, or flip over there on your phone or your device. In Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve have sinned. God has just given a curse to the serpent. But in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, we have what theologians refer to as the first gospel, or the first mention of the gospel. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15 reads this way. God says, I will put enmity, speaking to the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring, serpent, and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, serpent, the woman's offspring. You, serpent, will bruise his heel. This probably is the very most important verse for understanding your entire Bible. Because that is a prophecy from the Father himself. saying to the serpent, your offspring is going to try to do damage to the woman's offspring. And you will damage the offspring, the woman's offspring, his heel, but that offspring of the woman will crush your head. This is in reference to Jesus, the Messiah. Not the immediate offspring of Eve, but the lineage of offspring from Adam and Eve all the way down through Jesus himself. From Genesis 3 on, the devil is attempting to crush the promised seed. Think of this. When Pharaoh decrees in Exodus chapter 1 that all the Jewish boys under the age of 2 are to be killed, why did that Pharaoh do that? Because he wanted to? Certainly, yes, that is the answer. But he did that for this reason. It was a devilish plot to kill the seed, capital S, seed of the woman. When the Hittites, Canaanites, Jebusites attack Israel, it is with the intention to annihilate God's people and to make the promise of the coming Messiah impossible. Satan was at work when Herod learns from the wise men of a king soon to be born in Jerusalem or in Bethlehem. And he orders every Jewish boy under the age of 2 to be killed, yet Jesus is protected. Why? Because divine providence will always win the day. If the devil cannot destroy Messiah, what will he do next? He will go after the followers of Messiah. And since then, the church has felt the hot breath of her hellish foes, threatenings and slaughterings. Whether it is the Roman Empire's attempting to stamp out Christ's church, whether it is Islamic countries outlawing Christianity or Hindu extremists killing Christians in India, God's people have always had a bullseye on their back. Grace Life, you may not feel the hot blade of a sword severing your head from your body, or the smoking surge of a steel bullet ripping through your body. But I will say this to you. It is the evil one's intention to target you too, just like the people of God in Esther were targeted. Brothers and sisters, do not see your lack of a parking space at Target or hitting all the red lights on the way to work as the evil one's doing. Brothers and sisters, when you feel the temptation of lust in your heart, when you hear lies of unbelief in your head, when you sense your affections for Christ waning low and dull, know that the evil one, like Peter, desires to sift you as wheat. That you are in a spiritual war zone, shrapnel flying everywhere. And the battle for your head and the battle for your heart is for your eternal soul. This is what is going on in Esther chapter 3, is that the evil one is using an Agagite, an Amalekite, to stamp out the promised seed of the woman in Genesis chapter 3. So, God's silence, though, even through this thus far, is not a demonstration of unfaithfulness. Let me give you reality number 3. I say this to you, Christian. Do not fear. God's salvation is timely. Do not fear. God's salvation is timely. Now, I'm back in Esther 3. There is a recurring phrase that appears in chapter 3 at least 2 times. And we're going to read it. I want you to note the day the death sentence or the death decree was published. That's what I want you to note when we read this, okay? So I'm in Esther 3, and I want you to look at verse 7, and then we're going to drop down to verse 12. In Esther chapter 3, verse 7, get this. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, they cast lots before Haman, day after day, they cast it month after month, for how long? Till the 12th month? Which is the month of Adar. So one full year, the rolling die, and the rolling die, and the rolling die. Now look at verse 12. Then the king's scribes were summoned when? On the 13th day of the first month. So from verse 7 to verse 12, how much time has passed? 1 year, right? They're summoned, and on the 13th day of the first month, an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors who over all the provinces, and I think there was 127 or 147 according to Esther 1, to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script, right? So Jewish people would be able to read this in Hebrew. Persian people would be able to read it in their own language, and folks in other dialects, they too would be able to read it, right? Because this is a kingdom that goes from the Middle East all the way to India. Everybody's going to read this in their own dialect. It was written in the name of Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Now, did you notice when the decree was sent out? Right? It's in verse 12. It says it was sent out on the 13th day of the first month. Now, that means absolutely nothing to you and I, unless you know Jewish history. What happened on the 14th day? Let me put it this way. The 13th day of the first month, this is the eve of a Jewish holiday. You and I, it is the observance of Passover that begins on the 14th day. What is Passover? Passover is an annual remembrance of Israel's deliverance from the iron-fisted rule of Pharaoh. Remember what has happened? Moses goes in and he brings all the people together and he says, listen, on a certain night, you and I know is now the 14th day of the first month, Nisan, of the Jewish calendar. A death angel is going to come through Egypt. And if you have not sacrificed a spotless lamb and applied the blood of the lamb to the doorposts of your home, if you do that, the death angel, will pass over you, right? Which is where we get the term Passover. If you don't apply the blood to the posts of your house, the death angel will go in and will take the life of their firstborn child. And it happened to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians. And so when they celebrate the Passover, it was a remembrance of what? Of God's deliverance. Of how God is faithful to His people. It was a hopeful reminder that the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob would deliver His people once more. Here's the drama. The drama is that God faithfully delivers His people from Pharaoh, but will God deliver His compromised covenant people from the decree of Ahasuerus, and specifically the Agagite? Because we don't got King Saul around to help us anymore. And the Jews are asking this question. As they get ready to, so the decree comes out on the 13th, on the 14th day they celebrate, and while they are eating the roasted lamb, they know that a death sentence hangs over their head. And they're eating bitter herbs and lamb. What will God do? Will He provide another dramatic rescue? But folks, here's the problem. They have to live like that for 11 months. Now, because of the seat we occupy, you and I, we know how the story ends, right? In fact, Christian, we have an even greater advantage, do we not? What's the greater advantage? We know this, that the Passover supper points us to what? To another meal. What other meal would that be? The Lord's Supper, right? And we celebrate the Lord's Supper how often? At least around here, every month. We'll do it next Sunday. What are we doing when we celebrate the Lord's Supper? We are commemorating not just, folks, brothers, we are not just commemorating God's deliverance from the people of Israel from Egypt. What are we doing? We are commemorating the fact that from the foundation of the world, before the foundation of the world, that the eternal Lamb of God was slain so that God's people would be rescued in the day of trouble. This is what Esther is pointing us to. Beloved, do you see the Christ connection here? That God's divine providence is at work. And that just as the Father provided a way of escape from Egypt, and just as the Father provides a way of escape from hateful Haman, to use biblical language, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. Do not fear, saints. God's salvation is timely. And ultimately, that God rescues His chosen people from destruction. You see, the drama of life is alive and well, but fear not, because divine providence is timely. Now, before I close, I have to bring up one objection. And that objection is this. Pastor, I understand that God rescued Israel. Let me put it this way. God rescued Israel from in Egypt. I understand that God will rescue the Jewish people from hateful Haman. And I understand that the Lord's Supper points us to the death, burial, and resurrection of my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, which gives me a greater assurance of deliverance in the end. I get all that. I got it theologically. I can pass the systematic theology test. But what I need is, I need immediate rescue. Like, I'm the Jewish person eating the lamb on the Passover, and I know that I've got 11 months until my death sentence comes past. But I need rescue now. Look, that's exactly how the Jewish people felt. Look at verse 15. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king. The decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. What did the king and Haman do? They sat down and they drank. But what's happening in the city of Susa? Everything was thrown into confusion. You see, when God is silent and drama happens in my life, what's going on? The city is in confusion. My family is in confusion. Our church is in confusion. Our culture is in confusion. Our country is in confusion. Man, the world is in confusion. God, I just need some deliverance. I need a word of assurance. So for one full year, the Jews lived with anxiety and uncertainty because they're celebrating, but the death sentence doesn't happen until the 12th month. Here's what I want to say to you, as gently, as pastorally as I can, for those of you who are saying, I need rescue now. Here it is, that God is decidedly intent. God is decidedly intent to forward and advance His kingdom, His kingly rule in your life. Right? You want God to exercise, you want God to whip out His royal scepter and kind of fix everything. But what God is doing is He is intent to make sure that His kingly rule and His kingdom is going to advance where? In your heart. And in your life. And so while the city is in confusion, everyone's waiting for a word from God, for a deliverance from another Passover, for another Passover, what God is doing is He's working in your heart and in your life to bring you into not only submission, but into a greater trust with Him. God is seldom early. He is never late, but He is always on time. Friend, in the meantime, know this, that the cross is God's assurance to you that He will rescue you at the right time. We will likely never know the full extent of His purposes in our trials, but we do know this, that when we are the objects of hatred, when we are the victims of evil plots and schemes, when we are attacked, that God is still at work. And in those very moments of pain, when He draws us closer to Himself, so close that we actually experience the wooden cross and the cold, sharp nails and the razor sharp thorns, while He draws us close and we feel the pain of the crucifixion, we also feel His beating heart. And we see His compassionate eyes, so that the pain we experience aren't just moments of pain, but also in our death-like experiences, they are moments of God's grace. Do you remember Bill Wallace? Let me take you back that prison cell for a moment. I could read, I guess, the experiences that he went through, but it would turn your stomach. Wallace, God was silent for those final 3 months. The Christian church all across the United States were praying for Wallace and other missionaries. It appeared that God was silent for Wallace. There was no dramatic rescue, no sending an angel like the Apostle Peter to kind of free him from jail. Wallace died with excruciating pain. 43 years old, and he's dead. His memorial, Wallace's memorial, is not in the buildings named after him, even though there is a hospital in Korea named after Bill Wallace. Even though the Baptist Student Union of the University of Tennessee Medical Center is named after Bill Wallace. Even though there's a church in Knoxville, Tennessee called the Wallace Memorial Baptist Church. These are not, and I can think of other institutions and agencies and buildings named after Bill Wallace. These are not the memorial of Bill Wallace, but rather Bill Wallace's memorial are the hundreds who have been inspired to give their lives as missionaries. In fact, at the funeral in 1985, Patricia Stooksberry, who was a missionary in Costa Rica, Carter and Charlotte Davis, who were missionaries in Grenada, Dale Maddox, who was a missionary in Ecuador, and 25 other missionaries were identified as in pastoral ministry because of his direct influence. That's not counting the lives that were touched while in China for 16 years. Some would say that Wallace's life was cut short and wasted. He had a medical degree. Think about the money he could have had. He could have enjoyed a good retirement. But divine providence takes the drama of life and does what? brings glory and honor to God. Christian, you and maybe others may think that your pain is meaningless. But divine providence takes life's drama and furthers His eternal purposes in and through your life. And while you may never die at the hands of communist soldiers, God intends to do the same in your life. He intends to take the drama. He intends to take the wrongdoing done to you, or maybe the wrongdoing that you yourself made those decisions on, to further His plan. Why? Because, friends, God's silence is not unfaithfulness. But God's silence is His preparation to display His greater and grander plan, which is the glory and honor of Himself for all eternity. That is what God is calling you to, and it's what He wants to invite you into, that His name, His glory, may be renowned in all the earth. Let's pray.